BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening.
Hello and welcome to another BDNG episode in conversation with. My name is Emma Button and I'm the Events Education Lead for the BDNG. Today, the BDNG is in conversation with Alberto Barea, who is a nurse consultant, and he is here to discuss with Lyell Liverpool her recent published book called Systemic, How Racism is Making Us Ill. So I think I'll just start by introducing a bit about the BDNG. So we are a nursing-focused dermatological charity aimed to support nurses with up-to-date education. Particularly in recent months, we've held study days with a recent focus on skin of colour and how we can improve things in practice. So perhaps I can hand over to you now, Al. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, of course. So I'm Alberto Barea, and as you said, Emma, I'm a nurse consultant in dermatology at Kingston Hospital, but I'm also one of the executive members of the BDNG. I want to explain to the audience why I'm here. Why are we here? And it's a really funny story. So it all started in 2009 when I took a year away from the UK and I went to work in Holland, in the Netherlands, in The Hague. I work in a place called the International Health Center. And there I met a lovely pharmacist by the name of Ravia Liverpool. We became good friends, good colleagues. It was 15 years ago, I think 2009. And after 2009, I left Holland, went back to the UK, but kept in touch with Ravia. And I remember Ravia had two little or young girls. I kept in touch with Ravia via social media. And not so long ago, I came across a video on Instagram, a few videos about Leia. And what really caught my attention, I thought, oh yeah, Leia, she's Ravi's daughter. What caught my attention was a video that Leia made about skin and the difficulties that some individuals with darker skin tones can have in terms of diagnosis and also melanoma. And I was like, oh my God, this is a serendipity moment. Let's try to get in touch with Leia and see if she can come over to the UK and we can have a conversation. And you know what? She came over to the UK, not for me, she came for presenting her book. And I came across her book, which is called Systemic, How Racism is Making Us Ill. And here we have Lyell Liverpool. So welcome very much for being here today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So enough of me talking. So Lyell, tell us a little bit about you, a little bit of your background, and what made you writing this book as your first, probably the first of many books. But tell us about you.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much. I love that story. It's amazing how time flies, isn't it? But so I'm a science journalist. So I write news stories and feature articles for science magazines like New Scientist, Nature. I've also written for The Guardian, The Observer and Wired. So I cover the latest developments in scientific research and policy. But I've been particularly interested in inequalities in science, but also in health and medicine. And this was kind of also the inspiration for my new book. I had been reporting particularly on inequalities during the COVID-19 pandemic. So, for example, in the UK, we saw that people belonging to Black and Asian ethnic groups were experiencing worse outcomes with COVID. And as I kind of began to investigate that, it became clear that these inequalities are not just restricted to COVID, but we see that across the board with different health conditions, from cardiovascular disease to cancer to mental health conditions, but also conditions affecting the skin, which I know that you're really interested in as well. And so I started to look at some of the reasons for those inequalities, and I've been really interested in looking at the work that's being done within medicine and healthcare to try and make medical education more inclusive, to try and make sure that doctors and other healthcare workers are being taught how to recognize conditions across diverse skin tones. So I'd be happy to talk more about that.
That is excellent. One thing I want to ask you, because your book, the first title, the first word is systemic. So It's not just, and also another thing, us. Racism is making us ill, not just a specific cohort of individuals. Why is racism making all of us ill?
Yeah, thank you so much for mentioning that. I think, so the reason I titled it systemic is because I think a lot of these problems that contribute to inequalities in health are systemic. I really think racism is a global public health crisis, so it does affect all of us. We see that around the world, where there's racism, where there's discrimination, there are inequalities in health. But also we see that, you know, racism affects our healthcare systems. It makes them unfair, but also, you know, inefficient. So that wastes time, money, resources, including of the healthcare workers that are often already overstrained, as you'll probably have experience with that. And so I think that by tackling racism, it means that we can help improve those systems and make them work better for all of us. In the book, I also look at medical research, which is obviously upstream of kind of our health and healthcare. And there we also see that there are, you know, biases which affect the quality of that research, of that science, in terms of who is included in studies. This also affects, for example, medical devices, because there are devices, for example, that might work less well for people with darker skin tones due to lack of diversity in the development of those devices, or indeed in clinical trials or in genetic studies. So I think improving diversity there, increasing inclusion, is also beneficial to everyone. So I really believe that tackling racism and biases in medicine and science will be really beneficial to all of our health.
Thanks, thank you. Obviously we're here, this is like a dermatology nursing podcast, dermatology nursing group, so we're aiming predominantly at the dermatology specialist population or audience. Can you tell us a bit more about skin and what your findings in the book specific to dermatology?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something actually I look at a lot in the book, because I think skin, obviously this is important for dermatological conditions, but I think skin is kind of a window into our overall health. You know, when I interviewed a dermatologist based in the US for the book, and he was telling me that he thinks as a dermatologist, his role isn't just to diagnose conditions affecting the skin, but also to look for signs of conditions that might be happening internally that present on the skin. So I think skin is so, so important when it comes to assessing our health. And unfortunately, there are inequalities, there are biases that can affect the treatment of populations with diverse skin tones. So it's something that I actually had experience of myself going back to the Netherlands, where Alberto started us off. So growing up there, at some point I developed a skin condition, which took a very long time to get diagnosed. My mom took me to see different doctors, and we really struggled to get a diagnosis. Eventually, I moved to the UK, where I went to university. So I was studying biomedical science. And at the time, I eventually had another flare of this condition. I was seeing different doctors. And ultimately, I saw a doctor who just happened to have darker skin similar to mine. And he was the one who finally diagnosed me with eczema, or, you know, atopic dermatitis, which is a really common condition that I'm sure people listening to this podcast are familiar with. And I was really surprised with how long it took to get diagnosed, given that it's such a common condition. And he said that he suspects that because of the way it had presented on my skin, so I experienced some pigment loss, hyperpigmentation, and also itching and other symptoms, that perhaps the doctors weren't familiar with recognizing that on darker skin. And so this is something that got me thinking about how doctors diagnose patients and how conditions can look different on different patients, and what that might mean. to be honest, at the time, I didn't really look into it further. But much later, when I was researching other inequalities in health and also thinking about the book, I got to know a young British Nigerian woman named Kanayo, who she experienced a really deadly condition called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So it's really life-threatening. Again, probably you're more familiar with that than I am. But yeah, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, she developed that as an adverse reaction to a drug that she was taking at the time, a treatment, because she'd had a wisdom tooth removed. So it was something routine, but she developed that adverse reaction and she presented to A&E eventually three times until she was eventually taken more seriously, because initially she was kind of dismissed and had gone back and forth. But the third time she arrived at A&E, she collapsed and had to be resuscitated. And she believes that, again, there was a kind of failure of the healthcare workers who saw her to recognize the seriousness of her condition and also to diagnose her because of her darker skin. So she has similar brown skin, similar to mine. So then that made me think back to my experience, and I kind of realized that, okay, in my case, it wasn't such a life-threatening situation, but perhaps this is something that can affect people's health in much more serious cases. And I started to do some research to look at that, which, yeah, I'm happy. If you'd like, I can tell you a bit more about what I found there, but I'll pause in case you wanted to share anything on that.
Yeah, no, definitely. We have audience that is treating Stevens-Johnson syndrome and other dermatologic condition. And actually, I do have a personal anecdote as a clinician, very recent, that maybe I want to keep in the end, because it was inspired by your book and the presentation of your book. I want to reveal that at the end. Well, we can go back to skin and the findings. Yeah. But obviously, Emma, do you want to ask some questions?
Yeah, I guess I was wondering, like, can you tell us about your findings in regards to discrimination in clinical practice, particularly some of the, you know, the experiences that you may have had as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, with eczema, following my experience, I, you know, just did simple things like just Googling eczema. And I realized that hyperpigmentation is one of the ways that it can present, and that it can look different depending on skin tone. And also, I was kind of struck by the fact that when I Google eczema, even I've done this like recently the other day, a lot of the images that pop up just in a simple search will show how eczema looks on lighter skin. And so even for, you know, people or patients who want to learn more about what they might be experiencing just at home, just researching, it can be challenging. And this was similar for Kanayo, so the story that I just mentioned. She also, when she looked at the NHS website for Stevens-Johnson syndrome at the time, which I think it was in 2019, they didn't really show how that condition looks on darker skin. But since then, there have been changes. And I think this is a good example of how just a small change can really make a big difference. So now when you look at the NHS website, they also show images on darker skin. And I think that can also be helpful for just raising general awareness about how these conditions look. But of course, it's really important that healthcare workers can recognize these things, because that's like kind of when there's an emergency, this is who we turn to for help. And still, we see that there are some limitations in medical education. So there was research in the US showing that, you know, 75% of the images in medical textbooks showcase health conditions on lighter skin tones, and just 5% show how those conditions appear on darker skin, for example. And this, I think, this medical education really impacts, you know, how confident doctors will feel or healthcare workers will feel when they are diagnosing patients. And in my research, I came across a survey. So this was a survey of users of a medical teaching platform, an international medical teaching platform. And it found that only 5% of those medical professionals said that they felt really confident diagnosing conditions across diverse skin tones. So I think that also highlights the fact that, you know, healthcare and people working in healthcare are really caring. That's a caring profession. They want to help people. And sometimes maybe people feel that they don't have the education or they don't have the tools to be able to, you know, help and care for diverse populations. So I think that's an area where, we can definitely improve more. But there has also been really good work trying to increase diversity, for example, in medical education and in dermatology.
Would you mind commenting? You talk about kidney function. Would you mind telling us a bit more about that with the as a medical diagnostic?
Yeah, so this is less connected with skin, but I think it links in general to the themes of how biases can creep into medicine and in medical practice. This is also a positive story because there have been changes in this area. But yeah, a few years ago as a science journalist, I was reporting on what in the book I call race-based medicine. So this is where, you know, in healthcare, a person's race is being used to determine, for example, their diagnosis or their treatment in a way that has increasingly been seen to be, you know, unevidenced, but also potentially harmful to patients. So the kidney function testing is one example of this. So if your doctor wants to assess your kidney health, they'll measure the levels of creatinine in your blood. And based on this, they kind of plug that into an equation to calculate your kidney function. It's your EGFR, estimated glomerular filtration rate. I always struggle to say that. But that's basically a measure of how well your kidneys are working. And for a long time, embedded in that equation was a kind of multiplication factor if the patient is Black. So essentially, they were adjusting kidney function test results based on race or ethnicity. And this was could be traced back to a study in the US in the 90s, which found differences in EGFR between or differences, sorry, in creatinine levels between Black and white patients. But this study had a lot of limitations. It was small, didn't include such a huge proportion of African-American people. And then again, it's been kind of applied internationally without enough scrutiny. And since then, of course, you know, race is a social construct, so it doesn't have a basis in biology. But of course, discrimination and racism can affect our health. But the way it was being embedded was kind of assuming that there are biological differences between races, which isn't the case, particularly between Black people and people from other groups. And as a result, that was overestimating kidney health for Black patients. So there's been research here in the UK showing that the use of this multiplication factor in calculating kidney health leads to an overestimation of GFR for Black patients, which could lead then to worse outcomes. Because, of course, this is a measure of kidney health, which can then be used to inform treatments like deciding if someone has chronic kidney disease and needs dialysis or perhaps needs a transplant. Mm-hmm. So that can have really big consequences in terms of people's health. But thankfully, this story has a happy ending because when I was reporting on this issue in 2021, I got in touch with NICE here in the UK, so the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. They set medical guidelines, and they in 2021, based on that evidence that I mentioned, they updated their guideline to remove race as an adjustment in this kidney function equation. And since then, there have also been changes in the US, the American Society for Nephrology and the National Kidney Foundation. They also published joint recommendations relating to calculating kidney health. And they also recommended against the use of race in this equation. Similarly, actually this year, KDIGO, so that's Kidney Disease Improving Global Outcomes. It's an international organization which sets also recommendations, and they also removed race from their equation. So it seems, I would say it's a better late than never, right, to make these kinds of changes. Yeah. And it's good that more doctors, scientists, health workers have also been questioning the use of race in medicine in general. So this is a change that we're seeing across different fields. But I think it's a positive one because, yeah, there was evidence that, of course, using race in this way as a biological kind of construct is really unscientific and potentially harmful to people.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
And part of the root of these inequalities and from a clinical perspective are caused by research. There's a root in research conducted in the past. And I mean, you've been downplaying in your introduction. You haven't mentioned your amazing research background and your PhD. But from a research perspective, us as clinicians, when we come across new treatments for patients with skin conditions, we look at clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And clinical trials, they do actually provide their stratification of their population and for race as well. And it's very difficult for us because the majority of the trials that we are exposed to, they seem to have a wider disproportionate amount of Caucasian and white population or cohorts in the clinical trials. Mm-hmm. So for us clinicians, we want to know why, because there's a disproportionate number, how can this drug affect patients from different ethnic minorities or even different backgrounds. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's kind of upstream of healthcare. We have research, and this is something that obviously clinicians want to be up to date. They want to know what are the latest developments in research to then inform treatment. And if that research isn't inclusive or isn't representing the diverse populations that those clinicians see, then that can be really limiting in terms of the care that they can provide. So I think research is really important too. It's something I also look into in the book. Is you mentioned lack of diversity in clinical trials. It's true that the populations are overwhelmingly white, the participants in clinical trials, but also in genetic studies, we see almost 80% of participants are of European descent, just 2% or less are of recent African descent. And this is important because although, you know, 99.9% of our DNA is the same, there is that small amount that varies between individuals. And in genetics research in particular, we really want to be able to capture that because the whole point of genetics research is studying that variation so that we can learn about, you know, genes that are associated, for example, with particular diseases that we can then treat. So I think that's very important. And then with clinical trials, you know, there are also just huge benefits to being a participant in research, especially if you're in a situation where you might have, for example, cancer or a condition that is really life-threatening and you want to be able to access some kind of new treatment. That means that often people of color, people belonging to marginalized groups are kind of being excluded from that opportunity to participate in research and maybe to benefit from that. There's also evidence showing that, you know, patients who are treated in research active hospitals or institutions in general tend to have better health outcomes, perhaps because those institutions are just have that proximity to research. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, it means that people of color, people belonging to marginalized groups might be missing out on those benefits. So I think that's probably the biggest reason why it's important to increase inclusion. But also, as you say, the insights derived from those studies, we want them to be as, you know, applicable to everyone and be able to help all patients. So again, this is an area where I think there have been improvements. Like in recent years, there have been a lot of efforts in research, in medical research, to diversify participants in studies, include more people to make sure that more people can benefit from that, but also to increase the quality of the science, because there's a lot of evidence that diversity is beneficial in terms of the insights that we can gain from that research.
Yeah, and can I say to the audience listening, if you are participating to clinical trials, because a lot of nurses are involved in research, please reach out and try to include increase the diversity of the population that you recruit in your clinical trials.
Yeah, and maybe I'll just add to that sometimes there is also maybe some hesitancy from some ethnic groups to participate in research because there is a history in medicine of discrimination. People might have had bad experiences. And so I think it's important also on the side of, you know, those of us working in medical research or healthcare to kind of engage with that, answer people's questions and try to really make sure that people can feel comfortable in the healthcare setting. And I think the work that you're doing, I mean, even this podcast, the conversation we're having, the fact that we are now like more open to these ideas and thinking about inclusion, I think that's really helpful and hopefully should help people to feel more comfortable in that setting, but also be able to participate maybe in studies and in research that can help other people.
How did writing the book make you feel?
Good question. It's a difficult, you know, it's a really difficult subject. And I think when I was working on that, a lot of people say, oh, this is just such a depressing topic. And, you know, what can we do about this? But to be honest, I still feel very optimistic about things. And I felt that also writing the book. I mean, I'm really inspired by people like Kanayo, who I mentioned earlier, who experienced Stevens-Johnson syndrome. She's actually shared she took photos of herself when she was experiencing that, and she shared them with some researchers in the US who are trying to understand why clinicians sometimes struggle to recognize Stevens-Johnson syndrome particularly in patients of color. And they published a medical case study based on her story. And I think that's so amazing that she took this experience, which was obviously very difficult, but she kind of turned that into a learning exercise for hopefully many future medical students and clinicians to learn from. It's also something I love about science, you know, being I was a scientist in my past life, as Alberto mentioned, and also working in the medical field, that we're really looking at evidence and we want to update and learn from different experiences and findings so that we can improve our work. So I think I've met a lot of people working in healthcare who really care about this issue and want to make things better. I forgot to mention it before, but there's a medical student actually based in London. His name is Maloney Mukwende, and he actually worked with some of his teachers at medical school because he noticed this kind of lack of diversity in terms of how health conditions were shown in medical textbooks. And they developed a handbook called Mind the Gap. So it's a handbook of clinical signs on black and brown skin. He also has a website, blackandbrownskin.co.uk, which I think it's a great resource for anyone really who wants to educate themselves about, you know, the diversity of how health conditions can present on all sorts of skin tones. And yeah, he's also been doing work to try and improve medical education. So I think that's really, really great. There's also actually, I wanted to check. Oh yeah, her name is Dr. Sharon Belmo. I was just looking at my notes, but yeah. She's a dermatologist based also here in the UK, and she started kind of rewriting the curriculum for dermatology students. So in 2021, she wrote the first Dermatology for Skin of Colour syllabus for the UK Dermatology Specialist Training Curriculum. So I think that's really exciting that there's this kind of work and innovation in terms of improving education. And I actually think there's a lot of this work is happening in dermatology, probably because of that proximity to skin and thinking about skin. But I hope that other sort of in other areas of medicine, we can kind of learn from dermatology, because as I said, this affects, you know, all sorts of conditions might present on the skin. So it would be great if, you know, all kind of healthcare workers will be engaged to learn about this.
And I think what's great is in your book as well, you reference to Mind the Gap as well, don't you? I did pick up on that, you know, so it really is a fantastic book.
Thank you so much. Yeah, there's lots of resources. So I hope that people can also use it almost as a kind of, a source to find studies that I cite and more information to learn more about these different things we've talked
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And obviously, there are other resources in the BDNG, British Dermatological Nursing Group, and British Association of Dermatologists regarding ethnic skin and skin of color as well. But can I move to a broader subject? Last year, I went to Singapore at the World Congress of Dermatology, and I did a talk on how climate change affects the skin health. But in your book, you mentioned also the concept of environmental racism. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. And I would also love to hear about, the interactions of climate change and skin health. It sounds really interesting. But yeah, I mean, we know that climate change on a global scale, it disproportionately affects, marginalized people, particularly people of color in the global south. There's that inequality in terms of countries that are most affected by climate change. But even, you know, within wealthy countries like the UK or the US, we see inequalities in terms of how different groups are exposed, for example, to heat. So there's something called the urban heat island effect, which is when we have extreme heat, how in different areas, for example, if there's an area that has less trees to kind of release moisture and have that and provide shade and provide a cooling effect, that in people living in those neighborhoods who often are disproportionately people of color may be more exposed to heat, and there can be really harmful effects of heat. Maybe we don't sometimes think about this, but heat, you know, kills a lot of people, and this is an increasing problem as the planet is warming. So I think that's one area where we see inequalities, but also just in things that maybe we don't see, but even the air we breathe, we can't always see pollution, but air pollution is really an invisible killer that can affect our health. And there are inequalities, you know, people of color in England are more likely to live in a very polluted area. We also see in the US, for example, Black and Hispanic people are more likely to be exposed to air pollution, even though they contribute less to its production. So you see those sorts of inequalities, which then also translate to health problems, because, you know, air pollution has been linked to asthma, to lung cancer. We see in England higher rates of hospitalization with asthma for Black and Asian mm-hmm. ethnic groups, for example. So this is something that, again, it contributes to our health before we even, you know, reach a healthcare setting or arrive in hospital. It's our health is, you know, what we do, what we eat for breakfast, the air we breathe, and all these things in our environment. And that's something that, you know, speaking to clinicians for the book, a lot of clinicians told me that sometimes they feel like a lot of the racial inequities even start before they see patients. So I think that's also very important. And it's also why I called the book systemic, because I think these problems are systemic in our whole society, not just in medicine, but in general.
So to bring it home in a way, so what will be your message? Because the book, obviously, it talks about all of these issues. Mm-hmm. But also at the end, you want to leave a message of hope. So what's your message, particularly to the dermatology nurses who are listening to this podcast now?
Yes.
Apart from read my book.
Oh, yeah.
I really advocate
please, read
that
the book. No, I mean, even that, and the book, it's. I think it can also be as a resource. You can flick through that and maybe look at things that are most relevant to you. I really want it to be, a starting point, because I think from the book, there are so many other resources. But yeah, I would really want people, especially, those of us working in healthcare, to think about how it's racism that is harmful to health rather than anything kind of inherent about race. I think sometimes it's very easy. We hear all these statistics that, for example, Black women in the UK are 4 times more likely to die in pregnancy or childbirth, or Black people experience higher rates of cardiovascular disease or diabetes. And we see these inequalities and we think they're kind of permanent, or there's something inherent about, for example, being Black that means you have worse health. But, you know, there's nothing like that. In fact, it's not inevitable at all. And recognizing that racism is behind so much unfairness in health, it means that that's something we can do something about. We can begin to think about how to tackle the problem. And we've talked about this today, that we can improve medical education. We can teach all healthcare workers how to recognize conditions across diverse skin tones. And as I said, I think skin is so important. It's really a window into our overall health. But also, we've talked about removing racial bias from, for example, clinical algorithms, but also from medical research, right? Clinical trials, genetic studies. I think that's a huge area where we can make improvements, and improvements are already happening. And then in general, I think we can all educate ourselves. So this isn't just about those of us in healthcare, but just in our day-to-day lives, we can be informed about how conditions look on diverse skin tones. There are all these resources now that are like publicly available. So I think it's always great when we as patients want to kind of take control of our health and just feel empowered to talk about that with our healthcare worker so that we can understand what's happening in that setting. And I think we can all demand, fair treatment, whatever background we're from. But beyond that, I really think that these issues in society affect our health too. So, improving the environment we live in. We talked about climate change, but also just supporting campaigns for clean air, access to healthy food. All of these things will improve our health. I think absolutely. That was a long way to say, I think if we can really recognize racism as a crisis in public health, it does mean that we can then, dedicate resources to tackling that. And so I hope people in healthcare will start to focus more on how racism affects patients rather than thinking that there's anything about their race that, makes them more prone to illness.
Well, Laya, can I tell you how I went to see your book presentation in London and also started to read the book, how it impacted me? And I want to tell you an anecdote that it's true. And Emma works with me in Kingsland, so she can come and check the clinical notes if she doesn't believe me. So last week on Friday, I saw a lady from Sri Lanka with a Fitzpatrick skin type 5, so very dark brown skin, was booked to my skin cancer clinic, with multiple like small keratotic, so raised patches on her legs. There were like not really multiple, like 2 or 3 or so. So we use a device in dermatology, which is a dermatoscope, which is like a magnifying lens that we put on the skin to see all the structures and to have a magnifying mm-hmm. view. And as I was looking, my brain algorithm was scanning all of the pictures that I've studied. But obviously, as you mentioned, predominantly all the textbook, they show white skin. So I was a bit struggling to identify. I mean, it looked like something called seborrheic keratosis, which is like a benign warty lesion. But also the history, she was saying they were itchy and so on, made me think it could have an inflammatory origin, although it's more difficult to see hemoglobin, so the redness on the skin in people with dark skin tone.
Yeah.
So I thought it's an interesting conundrum. So am I going to go via the seborrheic keratosis, or am I going to go via the inflammatory route? And then I remember your anecdote, your book, and I thought, hold on a minute, I've got a colleague here that is working with me from Sri Lanka, and I wanted to come and have a look, this dermatologist, come and have a look and observe the skin with the dermatoscope and so on and see what he thinks about. And so he came, he saw this lady, and he basically reassured me that basically one lesion was a seborrheic keratosis and the other mm-hmm. lesion was a condition called lichen planus, which is a chronic inflammatory skin condition that manifests in some sort of small keratotic patches. It was a bit of both, but yeah. That really helped not just me as a clinician, but it helped the patient because otherwise, I would have had to send the patient for a biopsy and the patient would have had unnecessary scars on the skin. So that's a really interesting example on how it really opened up my mindset and it made me think, okay, let's hold on a minute. Let's get a colleague in. Let's bring, same thing as you saw, a dermatologist that had the same type of skin. Let me bring on board somebody who has the same type of skin and background and see what he thinks about it and look at this patient more holistically. And that was really helpful.
Yeah, it makes me really happy to hear that, you know, yeah, you're thinking about these things. And I think it will be also great as, you know, all healthcare workers and regardless of our skin color, we can learn how to recognize things on diverse skin tones. So I think this is also great when we collaborate with colleagues to just learn from each other's experience to improve. And yeah, I think, you know, skin, it is important. I think we touched briefly on skin cancer at the beginning, but we really see surprising inequalities there as well, where, of course, having more melanin in your skin is protective from skin cancer. But then there are statistics in the US, for example, where Black people are actually dying more from skin cancer because often it's diagnosed later and then it's more difficult to treat. So even there, when there are these conditions that we might think, you know, aren't such a problem for people with more melanin or with darker skin, there can still be inequalities there. So I think it's really great that, yeah, we pay more attention to these small details. It can be a sign of something more serious that might need treatment, like a cancer. The skin really provides an opportunity to diagnose these things. So I think it's really rewarding also to hear about the work that you're doing and how this can apply in practice.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, Lyle, thank you so much for agreeing to join us and recording this podcast. I honestly believe that our listeners will benefit from it. And I do hope that they purchase your book because it is brilliant. Systemic, How Racism is Making Us Ill. It's brilliant. So thank you to both of you. And thank you, Alberto, for arranging this as well. Today.
Thank you. And Lyle, one more thing. Are you going to have any more live events in future?
I might have an event in Oxford, but I'm still arranging this, so I can stay in touch and let you know. But no, I would love to do more. So if people are interested, they can also get in touch with me through my publisher is Bloomsbury, or through my literary agent, Janklo and Nesbitt. So if they visit my website is lyalliverpool.com, then they can find more information about how to get in touch. And I'll try to put information there if I'm doing any more events.
Thank you so much, Lyle.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.